Lecture 33, The Language of Science, The Changing Nature of 20th Century English.
Hello, and welcome to the world of science and technology. The impact of science and technology on the English language can be traced all the way back to the Renaissance, and we saw how the inkhorn terms of the 16th and the 17th century are in effect the scientific vocabulary of the age. In this lecture, I would like to talk about the impact of science and technology on American English, but I would like to do so not just by looking at modern terms of the 20th century, but by showing that many of these 20th century terms, like many 20th century technologies, have a 19th century origin. I'm going to focus on a clutch of words that begin in the late 19th century and that enable us to see science and technology changing permanently the tone and idiom of the English language. When we think of a word like attraction, we think of an emotional category. Yet, we must be aware that the term originally had meanings in electrical and magnetic theory. Indeed, when we look at so many of the terms of emotive or psychological experience in our own day, we're looking at words which someone like Samuel Johnson in the 18th century had recognized originally were terms of physical quality. Whole classes of words affect emotional response, and these words have their origins in many scientific, technical, or physical phenomena. Indeed, let's remember, too, that the dictionary, the lexicon in English, began as an attempt to grapple with these new words from sciences and art. The new world of words of the 17th century dictionary becomes the new world of words for 19th and 20th century technology. How can we explore some of these uses? Words like attraction and words like hello come to us by means of new electrical and technological innovations. In a few minutes, I'm going to spend a fair amount of time talking about hello, a fascinating word, a window onto attitudes, social and indeed moral, at the turn of the century. But let me focus now on a few aspects of the technical vocabulary. In this portion of my lecture, I'm going to be drawing on material culled by the historian Carolyn Marvin in a fascinating recent book of hers called When Old Technologies Were New, thinking about electric communication in the late 19th century. And when we think about electric communication, we need to think about changes in the history of the English language. Many of the examples from this book are taken from the popular press, and many of them resonate with our earlier discussions in this course of lectures about the nature of American English, the nature of the American people, the problems of lexicography, and the issues of neologism or coinages. In the 1880s and 90s, electricity changed irrevocably the everyday life of American people, but it also changed the possibilities of language. Phrases like electric shock or the terms of electricity gave rise to new words and new sources of humor. Here's a good one from the Terre Haute Express, a local journal of the 1880s and 90s. "George, dear," says the wife, "what kind of fruit is born by an electric light plant?" And George responds, "Electric currents, of course." This is what passed for late 19th century humor. Or the Electrical Review offers another one of about the same period. "When the intelligence of a disaster is flashed over wires electrically, a newspaper very properly calls it shocking news." Now, you can see in these little jokes here the bits and pieces of how a technical vocabulary affected everyday speech and how the idea of being shocked by something, in fact, almost no longer has about it its purely electrical quality. We can go back to words like bristle and horrid to compare words like shock. That is, we can look at these as phenomena of extension in lexis. And we can look at semantic change here operating where the word moves from its technical limited or physical meaning to an emotional general or figurative meaning. The San Francisco Chronicle in the late 19th century compared the plethora or the fecundity of electrical language to the inventiveness of terms and discourses about patent medicines, which popular language and culture revered with a similarly expansive and uncritical enthusiasm. These are the words of Carolyn Marvin, and she gives examples from the San Francisco Chronicle and from the journal Cosmopolitan, which at the turn of the century was a journal of popular everyday readership. Cosmopolitan says, "If such words prove popular, they hold their own, like a derby hat, or ice cream soda, or electric lights or telephones." What are the pressures for the coinages of new words? It's not simply a question of having new things to name, it's having a question of new activities. Now let me pause and say that one of the most important debates at the end of the 19th century about electricity was about electrocution as a form of capital punishment. And the larger question behind electrocution was part of a larger debate, really, between alternating current and direct current. Direct current is battery current, alternating current is generator current. Thomas Edison was the advocate of direct current. He believed in using batteries and direct current to move electricity over wires. The problem with direct current is that it degrades over long distances. George Westinghouse, Edison's great rival and the inventor of the air brake for the railroad train, Westinghouse was a great advocate of alternating current. And alternating current is produced by generators. It does not degrade over distances, and therefore it's possible to have generator stations that will produce electricity over long distances. The argument over alternating versus direct current was played out over the bodies of convicted criminals. The question was direct current safe or alternating current safe? The argument was, of course, to prove that direct current was safer than alternating current, you wanted, in effect, to electrocute somebody with alternating current to show how dangerous it was. And the early electrocutions were staged not as part of an argument about capital punishment in the large, but about the debate between which was safer, direct or alternating. Well, this question of execution by electricity gave rise not only to technological or moral, but to linguistic debates. The Electrical Review reported a variety of suggestions for words to describe electrocution, including electrophon, electricize, electronomy, electrophony, fanelectricize, fanelectricize, fanelectris, where the root, by the way, fan or thanatos comes from the Greek meaning death or the dead, electromort, where the French say mort, electromort now, electrotassy, fulmen, electricide, personal favorite of mine, like modeled on fratricide, electricide, electropionize, electrothenase, electrocution, which of course becomes our modern word, electroed, and electrostrike, and finally, says the Electrical Review, jolticus or volticus. Now, this string of words is remarkably illustrative of how new words are formed. They are formed morpheme by morpheme. You'll remember a morpheme is a collection of words, or, sorry, a collection of letters or sounds. A morpheme may also be one individual sound, which carry meaning. A morpheme like L-Y, Lee. That's the morpheme for an adverb. Quickly, slowly. We form adverbs by adding the morpheme ending, L-Y. The S sound can function as a morpheme for possession or plurality. The boy's book or two boys. New words are very often made up morpheme by morpheme. And so in this list of words, you can see the morphemes for death. Thanos, Thanatops from the Greek, or more, or from the French, or side morphemes for kill from the Latin. The Electrical Engineer magazine took an interest in this, and it argued in ways that seem to me resonate with so many of the discussions we've had about the problem of coming up with new terms. The charge is made against this country that slang is too freely adopted here, and that new words are welcome simply because they are novel, and despite their hybridity and barbarism. In some respects, the charge is true, but with a new society, living under new conditions and acquiring everyday new implements of industry, how is the check on base word coinage to be applied, and who is to enforce it? If the stock of old true coinage is sufficient, who will be capable of providing it to be so? And if the old coinage has to be melted down in order that new true coins, answering to new wants, may be furnished, who will do the minting? We coin new words. Here, the writer of The Electrical Engineer, in this essay, takes the idiom of coinage and reliteralizes it and talks about coins. But what I think is also nice about this passage is that it takes a word charge, meaning accusation, and of course inflects it with the sense of charge, electricity. This is, to put it bluntly, a highly charged piece of writing. And when we speak of the charge of writing, we are going back to these older discussions at the end of the 19th century about how we coin new words. What electricity does is it not only provides us with new terms, it provides us with a challenge for coining new terms. That is, whenever something new comes in, what are the verbs, what are the nouns, what are the modifiers that evolve? Let's talk about a little word, hello. I've spent some time in this course of lectures arguing that it is in the small words or the small pieces of words that we may see language change operating most effectively. Do and ing, morphemes and phonemes, bits and pieces, particles of language offer up windows into language change. I want to spend a little time talking about the word hello. We think of hello transparently as a greeting, as a way of greeting someone on the street or a way of greeting someone on the phone. But think about hello for a minute. Etymologically, hello comes from the word helloa or hello or hey. These are interjections to get attention. Now, the problem for the early telephone and the problem wrestled with by Bell, by Edison, and by other innovators in telephone technology was this. How can you address someone you cannot see? Forms of address, historically, are invariably linked to social class. When you meet someone, you gauge the social class of that person by his or her dress, or bearing, or look, or carriage, or speech to you. The problem with the telephone that was recognized as early as the early 1880s, very soon after the telephone was invented, was precisely this. How can you speak to someone whose social class you do not know? Are you speaking to a superior, a peer, or an inferior? And so, the problem arose of finding a term of address or greeting that would be class neutral. What could you say? You know, when you make a phone call in a foreign country, or when you hear people whose language is not English on the phone, you will realize that each country or society has asked and answered this question in its own way. So, for example, pronto becomes a way of answering the phone in Italy. Bueno becomes a way of answering the phone in Spanish-speaking countries. Occasionally, bitte becomes a way of answering the phone in German-speaking countries. Each one has taken a word, please, right away, or yes, or here, or good, and made it into the term of greeting and answering. This is an interesting problem for each country that adopts the telephone. Now, in the 1880s, the debate surged around the word hello. If you were to look up the word hello in the Oxford English Dictionary, you would find that its first appearances are in writings of the 1880s. And in 1889, Mark Twain, the author of Huckleberry Finn, published his historical satire, A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. And the premise of this novel is that the inventive young Connecticut Yankee, whose name is Hank, falls asleep, is knocked out, and is transported back into time to the age of King Arthur. Being a good and inventive Connecticut Yankee, Hank electrifies Arthur's court in all senses of the word. One of the things that Hank imagines doing, and eventually does, is wire King Arthur's court for the telephone. And we are told, in this novel published in 1889, that soon Hank had a whole bank of what Twain calls hello girls working. Now, a hello girl was an operator, because they were the ones who said hello. And in the early telephones, you made calls to a central. Hello, central, get me so-and-so. Now, in the 1880s, there was a great deal of debate about the use of the word hello, but also about the hello girl. And Twain's Connecticut Yankee is a marvelous window on this moment in linguistic change, when problems of propriety and decorum, language use, coinage, neologism, social class, and gender come together around the word hello. One of the things that developed in the 1880s was that men of a certain social class would have the operator at Central wake them up, in the way that in a modern hotel one might ask for a wake-up call from the front desk. Well, in the early exchanges, one could ask for a wake-up call from Central. These hello girls often acted as what might be thought of as personal alarm clocks, and there were stories that developed in newspapers, magazines and journals of the 1880s that derided the hello girl. Hello, girly, reads one of them. He gurgles to the sweet-voiced operator at the other end. I want to get up at 6:30 tomorrow morning. Would you be so good as to sound and ring me up then? If so, there'll be something in your stocking for Christmas time. Ever go to the theater? And then the editor of the journal continues, that's the way it begins. The telephone girls are an accommodating lot. But even if they were not there, they would be trouble if they failed to awake several thousand Bostonians every morning of the summer. For here it is a rule of the company that they accommodate patrons. Hello girls in the 1880s often became objects of male fantasy. One of the young ladies at the central office, reads one commentator, has a singularly pleasing voice, and it's just possible that her features match it. Now, one of the things that emerged at this time was the discussion of what would happen when the wife would answer the phone. Hello, 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 and the next morning the telephone rings. Here is another quotation from another journal of the 1880s. Horrified hubby sits up in bed in dazed surprise while Mrs. Jones goes to the phone. Hello, says Mrs. Jones. Hello, pet, comes back in a woman's voice. Hurry up and get up. I've been ringing for you long enough. Now, this little anecdote is beautiful because it gives us not just a story of hello, but it gives us the way in which American colloquial English is anecdotalizing technology. Horrified hubby. Another alliteration here. As if, you know, here's the husband just with his mouth open. And, of course, in this passage, published in the late 1880s, phone has an apostrophe before it, as if not quite yet the word phone is accepted. It's telephone, or the way in which, for example, some people will write the word cello with an apostrophe before it to indicate that it's really violoncello. These cuts away are features of how technological vocabulary become part of everyday idiom. So when Twain publishes A Connecticut Yankee in 1889, he's offering living social commentary. And when he talks about the hello girls, he's talking not just about the electrification of a country, he's talking about the electrification of a male populace. Stories that were shocking in their own day. What else shocks us about the language of technology? In keeping with the electrification of America in the 1880s and 90s, and at the turn of the century in general, America was also electrified and shocked by a new discipline, psychoanalysis. Sigmund Freud had developed and had early on promulgated in England and America through his visits and his disciples the idea of a psychoanalytic theory of the self and of desire. Now, in American and British English, we tend to think of Freud as a scientist of the mind, and we tend to use words of Latinate coinage to express Freudian concepts. Words like ego and id and superego give to the Freudian vocabulary a patina of the Latinate and therefore a veneer of science. But in Freud's original German, Freud used everyday German words to express the three parts of the psyche. And so what we call the ego, he simply called the ich, the I. Ego is Latin for I. What we call the id, Latin for it, Freud simply called es, which is German for it. And what we call the superego, Freud called über ich, the over or super I. This habit of translating Freud into English, I believe, changed radically the texture of psychoanalytic language. And it bequeathed to American and English readers the sense, not in Freud's original German, of a Latinate scientific language, which therefore made possible the plethora of scientifically based psychological and medical vocabulary to explain mental conditions. In effect, words such as schizophrenic, egocentric, fixate, or cathexis, these are the inkhorn terms of the early 20th century. And they function socially in the same way as the inkhorn terms functioned in the Renaissance, as coinages, as words based on Latin and Greek morphemes or elements, and as words that were seen as new or unusual or even alien to the general population. These words have filtered down to everyday speech, so one can talk about a complex without really necessarily committing to Freudianism. One can talk about being schizophrenic when one really means indecisive or of two minds. One can talk about egocentric when one simply wants to say that the person is concerned with something. One can talk about fixate, like fixating on something, and not imply that one is an obsessive or a compulsive. Similarly, other disciplines and emergent sciences of the early 20th century shaped our everyday language. In nuclear physics, for example, phrases such as critical mass, which originally describes the precise amount of plutonium or uranium necessary for an atomic explosion, critical mass now can be used metaphorically. I need a critical mass of students in a course, for example. Meltdown. Meltdown is what happens when a nuclear reactor goes critical. I'm having a meltdown. Fission and fusion. Now, what's interesting is these are words taken from biology. Cells divide by fission. The word fission was used in biology long before it was used in nuclear physics to describe the splitting up of cells and reproduction by fission. Nuclear fission is, in effect, a kind of re-metaphorization of the older biological terminology. Ground zero. Ground zero is where the bomb hits. What I love is when people mistake ground zero for something like square one. Every now and then I'll hear someone say, "Let's get back to ground zero." Now, the last place I want to get back to is ground zero. Nuke. To nuke. To destroy. Of course, my son now thinks of nuking something in the microwave. Or I would say waving it, but the idea of let's nuke the leftovers implies to someone of my age something far less appetizing than reheating food. Cosmology, the Big Bang, cosmic, galactic, light year, parsec. These are terms that come to us not just from science, but from science fiction. And clearly a word like Big Bang, which is so much a part of our current vocabulary at the end of the 20th century, can be turned into a metaphor for the beginning of something. Perhaps the more creative way of talking about the start than ground zero. Computers, input, output, software, hardware, boot up, net. We surf the net. Channel surfing, which we used to do on the couch, has become net surfing, which we now do at the desk. My favorite are the ware coinages. Originally, you had hardware, something that was made and existed. And then, on the model of hardware, was the coinage software. And now, what I find very interesting in artificial intelligence is the concept of wetware. Wetware is hardware that is living. Wetware is the term used to describe something that you make using a biological component, something that's living. Hardware, software, wetware. Another way in which English has increased its vocabulary in the 20th century in science and technology is through what's known as eponymy. Eponymy is the practice of naming something after somebody. An eponymous hero is the hero of a novel. Tom Jones is the eponymous hero of Tom Jones. Words like boycott, sandwich, maverick, chauvinism are words which are taken from names of individuals whose actions characterize certain forms of behavior. The Earl of Sandwich made a sandwich. Or to be a maverick is to be somebody who, like the lawmaker of the 19th century, was on his own. To boycott is not to participate in trade, and so on. Brand names are a kind of corporate eponymy. Kleenex, Thermos, Frigidaire, Victrolar, Hoover, for example. These are words which are also touchstones of not only language, but region and variety. One of the key differences between British and American English is the way in which eponymous words or brand names come to be verbs. In England, you do not vacuum the rug, you hoover the rug. And here, the word has now become a verb. My grandmother always talked about going to the Frigidaire or turning on the Victrola, where the individual brand name represented the thing as a whole. Indeed, words like aspirin and zipper are in fact old brand names which have come into such common use that their association with the corporations or the individuals who discovered and manufactured them has been lost. H.L. Mencken, in a passage I read in an earlier lecture, talked about the inventiveness of English. And we can see how the inventiveness of English in America is part and parcel of the American sense of invention. The figure of the American, like Hank in Connecticut Yankee, the figure of the American as inventor, as tinker, as discoverer, inventing and making new words. This little story of new words from science and technology, I'd like to suggest, not only offers us insight into how words come into the language or which words come into the language, but why we want words in American English. I think for many people, they signal that distinctively American quality of invention and discovery. Now, as worlds are left to us through computers, or how access is given to us through the world, through microscopy, telescopy, and artificial intelligence, we can, as it were, live out our inventive fantasies, not in the tinker shop, but in the world of words. New words are coming in constantly, and the future of American language may very well be a future that enables us to say hello freely to new words themselves. Thank you.